another thin crowd tonight, but the last time I used that expression, my wife said, have you looked around for some of these people? So I guess I can't use that expression. It's time to get started. Turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 26. We are looking this evening at the story of Uzziah. Call it pride before destruction, for reasons that will be obvious as we get deeper into the study. Again, reemphasizing the main point through this entire series of lessons, we're not so much concerned about all the things that these men did as kings, although some of it's pretty substantial, as we are about who they were as individuals, the character traits that they had. We sometimes tend to think of people in positions of great power as being somehow superhuman. You know, they have some kind of extraordinary abilities or skills or talents that put them way up there on that pedestal, and everybody else down below just looks up with awe and admiration that they've achieved this great pinnacle in their life. But if we could know these people personally and see what goes on behind closed doors that nobody else sees, we'd realize they're just like the rest of us. They have their flaws, they have their weaknesses, their temptations, their strong points, just like the rest of us do. And usually the way that they exercise their power is a reflection of that character. And that's what we've been seeing throughout this whole series of studies. None of these men that we've looked at could be called perfect in any sense of the word. Even one of the early ones that we looked at, David, man after God's own heart. I mean, yeah, there were so many great things that this man did, but there were also some pretty terrible things that he did as well. And we're seeing that pattern repeat itself over and over again. So really, it's more of, you know, how do things balance out in their lives or fail to balance out? Does it tend more to the good or more to the bad? Because none of them are perfect. And it's that blend that really stands out when we study the story of Uzziah in 2 Chronicles 26. We're going to limit our study to this one chapter because that's really all the Bible says about this man. There are a few other little snippets of information that we'll be making a passing reference to as we get into the lesson. Before we get going, Andy Harrison, could I ask you to lead us in prayer, please? Amen. All right. Let's get started here by looking at just kind of an overview of the man's life. If you look at the parallel passage in 2 Kings chapter 15, there's only 7 or 8 verses there that describe the entirety of his reign. Except there, he's called Azariah. Azariah in 2 Kings and Uzziah in 2 Chronicles. Same man. We find this quite frequently in the Old Testament, and even among these kings, that they tended sometimes to have separate names. We're told that he became king at age 16 following the assassination of his father, Amaziah. We won't pursue this, but there is some indication that he may have, at age 16, become a co-regent with his father, and may have kind of reigned together with his dad for some period of time before his dad was assassinated. We don't know all the details. Scriptures don't go into a great deal of complexity in describing this, so we'll just leave that behind. But the important thing, though, is that he's a teenager when he ascends to the highest position in the land. What would that kind of power do to the head of most 16-year-old boys? Yeah, get the big head, right? It's not hard to visualize what this could have done to this young man. However, he actually did pretty good. He reigned for 52 years. And by the way, that's not the longest reigning king. There was another one that reigned even longer than that. And the text tells us that he ruled quite well. During his reign, Judah prospered economically and militarily. The nation became stronger. It expanded. Some of the surrounding enemies were defeated. And we'll be looking at some other details in just a moment that talks about what he did. Later in his reign, he contracted leprosy under conditions that will be a big part of our study this evening. And then his son Jotham became co-regent or co-king with him for some period of time toward the end of his life. What was the standard reception that lepers had in society back then? They were isolated. They were shunned. How's that going to impact the king's work administering his empire? It's going to greatly complicate matters, isn't it? And so that's why his son then basically took over the reins of leadership while he was still alive. Just a little side note here, a bit of curiosity. Uzziah is mentioned in the opening verses of Isaiah, Hosea, and Amos, because all three of those prophets refer to them doing their work beginning in the reign of Uzziah and then going forward for several years. And then also, in both Zechariah 14:5 and in Amos 1:1, there's mention of an earthquake in the days of Uzziah. Now, it's interesting that those two prophets mention this earthquake, but when you read the history in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, the earthquake is never mentioned. Why not? It's not really a trick question. Why do you suppose the history writers just didn't mention it? Yeah, 52 years, there's a lot of stuff that happened that's not mentioned. It's not relevant, right? It's not really relevant to the purpose that the authors of Kings and Chronicles are trying to achieve. And Zechariah and Amos just mentioned the earthquake in passing, almost as an afterthought. But the fact that they mentioned it at all is an indication it must have been a pretty big one. Okay, so that's just kind of some background information about the man and his reign, as described in 2 Chronicles 26. Now what I'd like for us to do is to look at the positives and the negatives of this man. And I think the best way to do this is to just, we'll just start at the beginning and buzz through here. Start in verse 4. Actually, we'll read verses 4 and 5. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. He sought God in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding in the visions of God. And as long as he sought the Lord, God made him prosper. So the first two qualities that we see here is he did what was right, and he sought God. Now, we know what it means to do what is right. God's giving you instructions. You try to do it. What does it mean to seek God? He sought God. Okay, there's a desire to want to know what is the right thing to do. It's one thing to do the right thing because you feel coerced to do it, because it's good PR or it's good business. That's one thing. And what is that kind of obedience worth in the end? It's not worth much because you're doing it for the wrong reason. In this case, though, we have a young man who's doing the right thing. Why? Because he's seeking God. He genuinely wants to know, what is the will of God and how can I live my life to please God? Now, we noted a while ago, remember, he starts out in this position at 16 years of age at a time when most young men, given that kind of power, would just go crazy with it. Apparently, that didn't happen to him. He is, despite his youth, he's wise enough to recognize this is a terrible responsibility that has been placed on his shoulders, and he wants to do the job right. And he knows that God is the source of wisdom that will allow him to do the job the way it's supposed to be done. So, what do we think of Uzziah so far? What we've seen. Looks pretty good, right? And his approach to his work as king paid off. Militarily, he became exceedingly strong. Glance at verses 6 through 8. He went out and made war against the Philistines, broke down the wall of Gath, the wall of Jabneh, and the wall of Ashdod. These are chief cities of the Philistines. And he built cities around Ashdod and among the Philistines. God helped him against the Philistines, against the Arabians who lived in Gerbaal, and against the Meunites. Also, the Ammonites brought tribute to Uzziah. His fame spread as far as the entrance of Egypt, for he became exceedingly strong. And look in verse 11. Uzziah had an army of fighting men who went out to war by companies according to the number on their rolls prepared by Jael the scribe and Messiah the officer. And he goes on through the rest, these next several verses, and describes the great expense and trouble that he poured into building a strong military. One other thing that's kind of interesting, look in verse 15. He made devices in Jerusalem invented by skillful men to be on the towers and the corners to shoot arrows and large stones. What do we call those devices in our language? Catapults, yeah. Which has commentators scratching their heads because the catapult as we know it today wasn't invented until several hundred years later, as far as history tells us. However, there's some evidence that Persians had something like a catapult prior to that time. So this is entirely plausible that Uzziah has managed to collect some very sharp men who are technologically gifted, and they're able to build these kinds of machines. And, of course, they're defensive in nature. And by the way, there's one other thing, too, I'll just mention here. If you go back and read the previous chapter, during the reigns of Jotham and his father Amaziah, actually Jerusalem was overrun. And it was a pretty precarious period of time. And so Uzziah, really what we're reading up here is a man who's determined this is not going to happen again. God's people are not going to be embarrassed by a foreign army marching into our capital city and taking it over. So Amaziah is, you know, he's watching out for his people. He's expending his resources wisely to make his nation strong again. And then economically, look at verse 10. It says that he built towers in the desert. We assume these are like watchtowers to watch out for marauding bands of thieves and wild animals and so forth. And he dug many wells, for he had much livestock, both in the lowlands and in the plains. He also had farmers and vine dressers in the mountains and in Carmel, for he loved the soil. So economically, he's building up a strong agricultural sector in his economy. How do you suppose the people of Judah were eating during the reign of this king? Probably pretty well. You know, everybody had food on their table. Things are rocking along pretty smooth. And remember, how long did this man reign? 52 years. Now, we measure our economic prosperity or lack of prosperity usually in four-year presidential terms, right? If a guy is lucky, he might can squeeze 8 years out. But here you've got a man who is reigning for 52 years, and he's doing a pretty good job of it. Not only is he benefiting personally, but his people, his nation, is benefiting. Have you heard the statement that the best form of government is a benevolent dictatorship? Have you ever heard that? We usually like to think, well, the best form of government is a democracy or a representative republic, to be more precise. But actually, the best form of government is benevolent dictatorship. When we hear the word dictatorship, though, what do we usually think? Corruption, evil. Yeah, the guy at the top is just in it for himself, and he just crushes anybody that gets in his way. That's what I usually think of as a dictatorship. But if you modify that to a benevolent dictatorship, where the guy at the top genuinely cares for the people that he's ruling over, and he treats them fairly, and he administers justice throughout his kingdom, and he works hard in behalf of his people, what's going to happen to that nation, generally speaking? It'll prosper. It'll do quite well. And if you have a man that's doing that for 52 years, could you ask for anything better? Right? I mean, everything you see up to this point really puts this guy up in the ranks of the best among the kings of Judah. Okay, but things took a wrong turn. Look in verse 16. Everything down through verse 15 is very positive. But, verse 16, when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction, for he transgressed against the Lord his God by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. So two things here. His heart was lifted up, and he presumed to offer incense that he had no right to offer. Who was the only one that had the right to offer the incense in the temple? The priests, right, of the tribe of Levi. Now, he, being the king of Judah, is of the tribe of Judah. Yeah. So he has no right to just march into the temple and offer up this incense. And before we go on, let's pause for just a moment and ask, why this? Why, of all the things that he could have done, that his pride could have led him to do, why is it this one thing that really gets him in trouble? Why does he even want go into the temple to offer incense? Seems kind of a weird thing to do. He thinks he is? Yeah, what are those good reasons? Okay, he's presuming now to do something that God hasn't given him authority to do. And look in verse 17, Azariah the priest went in after him, and with him were 80 priests of the Lord, valiant men. They'd better be valiant, because who are they going up to confront? Yeah, the big man himself. This is a man that has, again, he's a dictator. He's a king. He can say off with their heads and make it count. So they have to be valiant men. Anyway, these 80 men go in after Uzziah, and they withstood King Uzziah and said to him, "It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have trespassed. You shall have no honor from the Lord God." Wow. Did these guys hold anything back? Nope. I mean, they shelled the corn with Uzziah, you know. He had no business being in there and trying to fill the role of a priest. That was their job. And that was a job given them by God. And for Uzziah to just march in there like he owned the place and presume to do something that only the priests were allowed to do was just the height of arrogance. But it gives you a hint of what's going on in the mind of this man. When the text said earlier, his heart was lifted up. What does that mean? His heart was lifted up. Proud? The rules don't apply to me. Yeah. I can do whatever I want. And why can I do whatever I want? Well, because he's strong, right? Yeah. He's king. And hey, everything's going fine. It's rocking along great. And yeah, I just don't have to worry about things. I can do whatever I want now. Now, we are not told at what point in his reign this change of heart came over him. Apparently, it's toward the latter half or third of his reign, because there had to have been enough time for him to accomplish all the good things that we've read up to this point. But again, he started out as a young man, as one who sought the Lord. He wanted to know what God's will was. And that tells us something about his state of heart at that time. But then something changed. The power went to his head. And over time, he turned into not a benevolent dictator, but a ruthless dictator. Enough that he felt like he could just march into the temple and do whatever he wanted to do, no matter what God had said. And so the priests, then it fell to them to have to go into the temple and confront Uzziah for his disobedience. And then, look at verses 19 and 20, how this played out. Now they confront him in verse 18. Then Uzziah became furious, and he had a censer in his hand to burn incense, and while he was angry with the priest, leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priest in the house of the Lord beside the incense altar. And then the next couple of verses describes them having to rush Uzziah out, because now you have a leper inside the holy place. And that, there's no way that can happen. So these priests rush him out, get him out of there. I mean, clearly what has happened here? People don't develop leprosy just like that. What's happened? God has stepped in now. It's not just the priest confronting him. God has instantaneously inflicted a punishment upon him for his brazen act. And do you think Uzziah got the message? I would hope so. How long did his leprosy last? The rest of his life. Yeah. Yeah, he was never cured of this. By the way, do you catch an echo here of something similar that happened many years before to somebody else? Remember the story? I'll give you a hint. It's while the Israelites are in the wilderness, having left Egypt. They're on their way to the Promised Land. I'll give you another hint. Let's narrow it down to the family of Moses. Well, where are you guys on Sunday morning when we're studying all these things every 4 years? I'm sorry? Well, okay, Aaron had a role in this, but there's somebody else in the family. That's not what we're talking about. A third hint, it's tied to leprosy. Oh, you're just going to beat your head when you finally hear it, because I know you know it. What happened with Aaron and Miriam? How? I'm sorry? Well, it was a little more than unsolicited advice. Okay. Aaron and Moses basically confronted Aaron and Miriam confronted their little brother Moses. And basically the message was, look, we're just as important as you are here. You know, why are you carrying all the freight? And basically they were questioning his relationship, I mean, his authority. And Miriam, of the two, was stricken with leprosy and told to go outside the camp for, what was it, 7 or 8 days? And I just see a parallel between that story and this. Miriam, after the 7 or 8 days, her leprosy was cured, she was restored, everything was fine. Except she learned a lesson from it. Here, Uzziah is stricken for his impunity in daring to do something that he shouldn't have done. And he's never cured. He lives out the rest of his days as a leper. So God has some tricks up his sleeves when people get out of hand. And in this case, Miriam and Uzziah both pay for it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
We can do this our way. Yeah, exactly. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Okay, so, and by the way, we might pause for just a moment here. Why do you suppose Uzziah, when these priests come up to him and jump him about what he has done, why do you suppose he gets angry? Why does he become furious at these men? Yeah, he sees himself as above them. You know, how dare you challenge me? I'm the king. And, well, they were doing what they were supposed to do. And confronting somebody who was out of line, even if he was the king. And this was God's way, the leprosy was God's way of reminding Uzziah who really is the boss. And it wasn't him. So his getting all bent out of shape over the priest and what they were doing, he was just compounding his sin and just making it worse. Okay, so this is the story of Uzziah, and particularly the change that occurred in his character. What we're going to do now, in the remainder of our time, is apply what we've learned. There's a statement in the book of Proverbs, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Have we seen this kind of thing play out before, even today? The people get in a position of power or success, and it goes to their head. And they end up just getting full of themselves and thinking, hey, the rules don't apply to me. You know, I'm doing so great, I can pretty much do whatever now, and I can get by with it. And that seems to be what's going on here. There was a fellow in Great Britain back in the 1800s that made this statement. You've often heard it quoted. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Let's just start with the first part of that. What do we mean, power corrupts? Mm-hmm. What is power, by the way? Let's talk about that. Freedom to do what you want to do, and you have the resources to do it, right? And furthermore, you probably have people that you can order around to make sure it gets done. I mean, that's the essence of power. And when people are given that kind of power, that kind of authority, it's very easy for it to go to their heads. And as Dan described, they can begin to think, well, I can do whatever I want. And it corrupts their character on the inside. And the humility that they once had can be lost. Great men are only a step away from becoming awful men. And Uzziah is just one example of that. Can you think of other examples in the Bible or in history of men who started out good and ended up pretty bad because of the power? Saul. Who else? Well, Solomon would fit in that category. I think we could plug David in here. You know, for most of his life, he was a very good man, very decent man, but boy, when he went off the rails with Bathsheba and Uriah, he went off in a big way. I don't know how else to explain that, but that the power that he was enjoying for several years went to his head, and he thought the rules no longer applied to himself. So pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall, and pride usually does that. When people just kind of get full of themselves, it's just a matter of time before it's going to blow up in their faces. It's going to come back and bite them in a big way. And they brought it on themselves. Pride often grows out of success. And I like this statement here, that the greatest test of faith is not hardship, but it's success. Have you ever thought about that? We often think in terms of, boy, what would happen if I lost my job, if I lost my health, if, you know, something like Job, that story, if that were to happen to me, how would I be able to stand up under that adversity? How would it affect my faith? And we often think in those terms, which is a good thing to help prepare us for the bad times that come. But do we ever stop and think when things are going well in our lives and good things start coming our way? We work real hard, we save, we apply ourselves, we treat other people right, and all of a sudden, good things start coming our way, as it should. Do we ever stop and think, where's this going? What are the risks here? Do we ever recognize that there are risks in that sort of situation? We usually don't. Brian, you had a comment? Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. The rich fool, God blessed him immensely. And he, I can say he deserved it. But it went to his head and God just kind of receded in the background. And it all became about him then. And that's often what happens to us. Success is a good thing, but only if accompanied by humility. And that, I would have to say, is one of the rarest combinations that you'll ever find. And that's people who are extremely successful in life. They've done very well, but they're also very humble. They don't wear their riches on their sleeve. They don't parade their wealth and their success and their accomplishments in front of other people. They don't treat other people in a demeaning fashion because the others are not as successful or as powerful or as whatever as they are. And it is just a really extremely rare thing to see people who are both successful and humble. Apostasy always begins in the heart. What's the first clue we're given that Uzziah was headed down the wrong path? Remember? Yeah, it says when he was strong, what was it? When his heart was strong, he was lifted up to his destruction. For he transgressed against the Lord. And apostasy always does that. It starts in our thought processes, how we're thinking about things. Describe Uzziah's thought process. Actually, we've already done it several times tonight. But what was going on in his head that led him down this path? Do you suppose that there could have also been an element in his working in his heart that, you know, I'm a pretty humble guy. I've been seeking God all these years, and boy, look what it's done for me. It's really set me up here. I'm not like all these other people out here. Do you see an irony at work here? In fact, make the connection to the Jesus' parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. What was the Pharisee's self-evaluation?
Lucky to have me.
Yeah, God, you're lucky to have me. I'm not like other men. You know, I fast twice a week and I give tithes and I don't run around with my wife and all these other good things. This is what humanity ought to be, God, and I am that kind of... And yet, what did Jesus say about that man? He went away unjustified. Yeah, God's not impressed with that. The point I'm trying to make here, one of the things that can get us in trouble, if we're talking about the heart and apostasy, one of the things that can be going on in our heart is that we can convince ourselves we're so good. And that itself is a sign of pride that can get us in trouble. And that seems to be what was at work here in Uzziah. Anger in response to rebuke is a sign of pride in the heart. Is it easy to be on the receiving end of criticism? If somebody comes up to you with a criticism, is it easy to stand there and listen to it? What's your natural defense mechanism? Yeah, to turn it back around on them in some way. Now, we may not blow up about it, but somehow we're going to deflect that criticism. This is not fair. It's not right. It's unjustified. it's over the top, whatever. I mean, we'll come up with some way to deflect the criticism. In his case, Uzziah just blew up. He was furious with these priests for even daring to question him. That in itself was an indication of how far off the rails he had gone. If you find yourself in a situation where you are criticized and you feel the anger welling up inside, you want to lash back at your critic, that right there is an indication you've probably got a problem with pride. You need to look deep in your heart and figure out, why am I so upset at this? Why am I feeling hot under the collar because somebody has felt a need to come to me and talk to me about my behavior or about something that I've done wrong? I ought to, if I'm a wise man, I ought to listen to what they have to say. I may not agree with it after I hear it, but at least I ought to hear it. Humility will always do that. Pride will not. A fine start does not guarantee a strong finish. You know, suppose Uzziah kept a scrapbook of all the things that he learned in seeking God in those early years and all the accomplishments that he achieved and how God had blessed him through all those early years of his reign. He could look back on that and say, see what kind of a great king I am? Well, okay. What guarantee is that of the future? In order for him to finish strong, what's he going to have to do? He's going to have to maintain the same character that got him through those early years. And that's what he lost sight of. Just because we start strong doesn't guarantee we're going to finish strong. And then finally, God's commandments must be honored. That gets back to a point that somebody made a while ago. And this is just a classic Old Testament example of the silence of God. Did God ever say in the law of Moses, people from the tribe of Judah shall not serve as priests or perform the function of priests? He never said that. What did he say? The men of the tribe of Levi, the descendants of Aaron, they shall be the priests under this system of religion. And that's all he had to say. And it's a great way to teach somebody the concept of the silence of God. God doesn't have to tell us, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do 10,000 other things, but do this one thing. All he has to do is say, I want you to do this. And that rules out any substitutes, right? And this is a classic case of this. Uzziah had no business in that temple offering incense. And he had to learn the hard way that God means what he says and what he doesn't say. Okay, next week we are going to look at Hezekiah. And this is kind of the flip side of Uzziah. I call this one Humility on the Throne. This was a man that, in many respects, had a lot of the same reasons to be proud and cocky, but it affected him in a different way.